As always, I just appreciate you guys asking me back. I enjoy being with you in this place, so thank you. Today, we're going to be in Mark chapters 8 through 10. We're not going to cover everything that's in those three chapters, but we're going to start in Mark 8:34. That's going to be our foundation text today, Mark 8:34. And calling the crowd to him with his disciples, and this is, of course, Jesus, he said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." So that's the message today. That's the sermon in one verse. So if you're planning on tuning me out for the rest of the time, make sure that single verse sinks in, because that's what you need to walk out of here with. But I do want to unpack that this morning, because it is a hard saying. And I think it's really been softened by our culture's interpretation of that verse, because I think many of us, I know I've had the tendency to read this verse with my own burdens in mind. The obstacles that we all face as human beings, the thankless job, the rotten relationships, the hardships we face, sickness, death, taxes, whatever you want to insert there. I think we have a tendency to identify those things as the cross we are to bear. And I think we think when we successfully endure those trials, those struggles, and we're somehow practically applying the teaching in Mark 8:34. And maybe you fully understand this verse, and that's nothing you've ever thought of. But I know personally in my life, I have interpreted this verse thinking about my cross in that context. And I think specifically back to the year 2020, and that's a big year. When I say 2020, I'm sure all sorts of things go through your head. But for me, personally, that was the first year of my career. So I'm fresh out of college. I started my career. We had Carson that year. We bought a house that year. Me and Kara both lost multiple grandparents. My dog died. And then on top of all that, all the COVID stuff. And we know how that changed the world that we live in. And it was like I entered the adult world finally, and the world just turned on its head and got set on fire is what it felt like. It was a really overwhelming year for me. A lot of new stuff, a lot of challenges. And I prayed almost daily, "God, help me to bear my cross. Help me to bear my cross. Give me the strength to follow after you." And he did. He answered that prayer. He carried us through and really blessed that year for us. But is that what Jesus meant in Mark 8:34? Is the cross simply a metaphor for the burdens that we have to bear in this life? And it's an understandable interpretation. I don't think it's a completely erroneous interpretation of the verse, especially on this side of the cross, because the cross symbolizes a lot of different things to us. It symbolizes the power of God, the sovereignty of God. It symbolizes hope and mercy and grace and the love of God. It represents all of those things. But in the original context that Jesus made this statement, is that the way the crowds, the disciples, would have viewed a cross? Is that what it would have symbolized to them? No, not at all. The cross had a singular meaning to the people of that day, the people who originally heard Jesus make that statement. The cross was a symbol of death. It was a symbol of execution. It was a symbol of punishment. And it was a punishment that wasn't just reserved for the most heinous criminals of the day, for the rapists and the murderers. It was actually a punishment that was reserved for those who were threatening the peace and stability of the Roman Empire. And they put him up on that cross to make an example out of him. And that's what the cross symbolized to the people hearing Jesus speak in Mark 8:34. That's what the cross symbolized to them. It symbolized death, fear, punishment, and subjection. So Jesus was teaching them, that if we're going to follow him, then we have to be willing to die. Because that's what the cross meant. You have to be willing to die. You have to give up yourself. You have to give up your own will to be a disciple of Christ. It's an absolute surrender. That's what he's teaching here. So when Jesus carried his cross up Calvary's hill, it wasn't a metaphor. It wasn't symbolism. He literally carried the cross on his back up that hill, and then he was crucified on that cross. Because that was the will of God. That's what was required of him. So deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow him. A hard saying, a very tough pill to swallow, a very high calling, but it is what is required of us as well. And many will not ever heed this call. And many of us may be sitting in here, have not truly answered that call. And I can assure you today, I'm preaching to myself, all right? And I think maybe some of you who've heard me preach up here, I'm typically preaching to myself, and I'm hoping you get something out of it too. But I found in my life that there are some major obstacles to discipleship. It is not a straight line journey. And there are obstacles that I try to ignore as much as I can because I don't like what they say about me. But I believe if we study this teaching of Jesus in Mark 8:34, if we study it in the original context that he was teaching it, then we can start to identify those obstacles and see them more clearly so that we can deal with them. So let's talk about that context of Mark 8:34 that we're going to be studying today. So the immediate context of the statement made in Mark 8:34 is Jesus is foretelling his death. He just told his apostles that he is going to be rejected and he's going to be killed. And after 3 days, he's going to rise again. So the ensuing take up your cross and follow me is going to come quickly after that prophecy that Jesus makes. And this is not the only time in Mark 8 that Jesus foretells his death. In fact, he explicitly does this 3 times throughout Mark 8, 9, and 10. He's going to foretell his death 3 times. And you can read this in the other, in Matthew and Luke, the Synoptic Gospels, like we talked about this morning. If you want to cross-check some of the work we're going to do today, in Matthew, it's chapter 17 through 20. You can find the 3 same instances where Jesus foretells his death. And in Luke, chapter 9 and chapter 17 through 18, you'll find the same prophecies again. And then there's the book of John, which Henry talked about this morning. And you're not going to find those 3 prophecies in the book of John. And Henry pretty thoroughly explained this morning why that's not the case. But there are times throughout John where Jesus is making statements that imply that he is talking about his death openly. And one of those instances in John 14:29. He says, "And now I have told you before it takes place," and he's referring to his death, "so that when it does take place, you might believe." So I thought that went well with what Henry talked about this morning. So John's not just denying that these prophecies happened. He's just not taking the time to describe them because they'd already been described by Matthew and Mark and Luke. So these foretellings, these prophecies are the context of Jesus' call to action in Mark 8:34. And if you study these 3 instances closely, there's another key piece of context. Those foretellings are flanked by conversations between the apostles and Jesus. And they're important conversations, and they're very personal and revealing conversations, especially because of their proximity to Jesus talking about his death. So, in studying these foretellings, these conversations, I've pinpointed a few misconceptions and characteristics the apostles had that were inhibiting them from truly taking up their cross and following Jesus. Because for a time, all right, the apostles were not the greatest disciples, okay? They didn't understand the big picture. They didn't understand the kingdom, which was understanding because they hadn't seen everything unfold to that point. So this morning, I want to look at those three foretellings, these three conversations that follow, because it's those characteristics and misconceptions that they had that caused them to stumble that we still deal with today. It's the same obstacles that we will face. So let's start in Mark 8 and verse 31. So this is the first record of Jesus foretelling his death. So as we read the foretelling, make sure you pay attention to the conversation that follows. That's the main part we're going to talk about. So Mark 8, 31 through 33. And Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan. You are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." So, whether the apostles liked it or not, Peter had positioned himself as their leader. And part of that is because he was part of Jesus' inner circle, right? But Peter liked to be in charge of the other guys. So just try to imagine this interaction unfold. Jesus is up in front of the crowds. He's teaching. He's saying these things. And then Peter's wiggling his way to the front and kind of motioning to Jesus. Hey, Jesus, come over here for a second. So Peter's interrupting whatever Jesus is teaching about. He's interrupting what's going on. And he pulls Jesus to the side. And I don't know what Peter said. All right. It says he rebuked him. But just from what we know of Peter, he was probably like, "Hey, Jesus, you know, I know you like to speak in the parables and the metaphors. And I get it. You know, I get it. I'm Peter. Right? I get it. But it kind of scares everyone else. It scares the kids. So if you could just not talk like that, it's really not good for our movement when you talk about dying. It's not helping anything out." And again, I don't know what Peter said, okay, but it's hard to imagine someone rebuking Jesus and what they would say. Surely he wasn't chewing Jesus out, but I mean, that's what the word rebuke implies. So imagine again, what is Jesus thinking as this is happening? I mean, we know Jesus never sinned, but the next words to come out of Jesus' mouth are, he calls Peter Satan. So it's safe to say Jesus is angry. He is not pleased with Peter at all and what he's doing. I mean, Peter was a fisherman. Jesus pulled this guy off the docks. He's a nothing. And he's chewing God in the flesh out. That's what he's doing. Jesus was there at the right hand of God when Peter was being created. And Peter has the audacity to chew Jesus out. So what does this conversation reveal about the followers of Jesus and about Peter? And I think it reveals that there was a part of them, of his followers, of Peter, that was ashamed of Jesus. And you might disagree with that word, ashamed, especially you think a few verses earlier in chapter 8, verse 27. If you look at that, that's where Peter makes the public confession. "We believe that you are the Christ, Jesus, the Son of the living God." A pretty bold confession. So how could that same man, how could I stand up here and say he was ashamed of Jesus? Well, look at the text. After Jesus rebukes Peter, that's the moment Jesus turns to the crowds and he makes the statement, "If you're going to follow me, you have to take up your cross." And then he's going to go on a few verses later in verse 38 and he's going to say, "Whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. So Jesus identifies the reason Peter responds to his teaching about his own death in the way he does is because there was a part of Peter that was ashamed of him. So that's the first obstacle, shame. Can you relate? Is this an obstacle you face? The majority of us in here right now, at some point, we publicly confessed our faith in Jesus. And maybe a lot like Peter did. When you were standing in the baptistry, getting ready to be baptized, maybe you phrased your confession just like Peter did. I believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And if you're still here all these years after you did that, that means you're still trying to be a disciple of Jesus. You're still trying to follow after him. We go to church. We read our Bibles. We strive to be morally upright. Every once in a while, we'll attempt some evangelism, right? We're attempting discipleship. But every now and again, we find ourselves in scenarios, at least I do, where we shrink back. And it's because of shame. So just a specific example that maybe you can relate to. This happens to me at work every once in a while. The school I work at, my team, we're very close to the same age. We're all in the same stage of life. We're all great friends. We have a great time together. And since we have these friendships, we have a lot of talks, a lot of conversations about a wide range of things. And many of those people are professing Christians. So we will talk about faith. We'll talk about religion. And we've had some really great talks. And I've been able to boldly proclaim my faith in Jesus to them. And that's all well and good. But there are times where we venture into topics that I know if I bring up what Jesus actually said about what it is we're talking about, I'm going to hurt their feelings. If I tell them what the Bible actually says about what it is we're talking about, I'm going to create an awkward situation. I'm going to strain my relationship with them. And I'm not guessing at that. I know that will happen based on the way they're talking about those things. So I choose to keep my mouth shut sometimes. And I'll tell myself it's important. It's more important that I have a really strong, loving relationship with these people. In a few years, when that relationship's rock solid, then I'll be even more bold. And I'll tell them exactly what the Bible says about whatever it is we're talking about. But that's a lie that I tell myself to make myself feel better. Because the reality is, there's a small part of me that is ashamed of the words of Jesus. I mean, don't get me wrong, I believe them. I believe them, but the issue is I don't like the way some of those words make my friends feel. I'm a lot like Peter. I like when Jesus is healing the sick people. I like when he's feeding the starving people. I like when he's talking about love and mercy and inclusion. I'm all about that. I love when Jesus is talking about those things. But when he starts talking about dying and denying yourself and taking up a cross, sometimes in certain scenarios I'll shrink back from that language because I don't want to be rejected. I don't want to hurt my friends' feelings. I don't want to risk losing those friends. I don't want to risk injuring my career in any way. And hopefully, I mean, I went out on a limb there. I shared something personal. Hopefully I'm not alone there. Maybe this is an issue you've experienced. And maybe it's not the workplace for you. Maybe it's with certain members of your family. Maybe it's with certain friends elsewhere. Maybe it's on social media that you will occasionally shrink back. And maybe it's just a little bit of shame every now and again, but it's a major obstacle. No matter how small that shame is within you, it is a major obstacle. There's an old saying about shame. Shame corrodes the very part of you that makes you believe in something greater. Just a little bit of shame. It's all it takes. So deny your shame, take up your cross, and follow him. Let's look at the next instance in Mark chapter 9, in verse 30. This is the second time Jesus is going to foretell his death. And again, pay careful attention to the conversation that's going to follow. So Mark 9, starting in verse 30. They went on from there and passed through Galilee. And he did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise." But they did not understand the saying. They were afraid to ask him. And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you guys discussing on the way?" But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12, and he said to them, "If anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all." And he took a child and put him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." Who's the greatest? That was the conversation topic after Jesus spent some time teaching about his death. That's what they decided to talk about on the way to Capernaum. So the temptation here is to look down on the apostles for being really immature. Who's the greatest? That's really what they were discussing. But I'm certain if we were there, the conversation would not have sounded too abnormal to us. If we knew the context that the conversation was being had, I'm certain it would not have sounded too odd to us. Because I'm sure it was not the Apostle John teasing Peter, hey, Peter, Jesus loves me more than you. I'm the apostle that Jesus loves. I'm sure that's not how the conversation about who's the greatest began. But maybe it was something like John telling Peter, "Hey, Peter, once we get to Capernaum, once we get to town, I need you to run out to the Sea of Galilee and catch some fish for dinner tonight." And on hearing that, you think Peter would have liked that? No, that would have made Peter indignant, because he was probably thinking, "Really? I'm one of the inner circle guys too. This is a job that's below me. Have James the Lesser go do it." And that would have made James mad, because he gets called the Lesser, right? And then they probably all started arguing about who should have to take care of dinner, because the job was below all of them. Again, I don't know what sparked the conversation about who is the greatest, but I know that these apostles had a nature like ours. So I'm certain the conversation would have sounded familiar to us. So when they get to town, though, Jesus again puts everything into proper perspective. He sits down and tells them, "That's not the way this kingdom works. You think you're so great because you were chosen by me, but look at me, I'm the king. And I came here to serve you. I came here to die for you. This little child right here, he's more prominent in the kingdom than you are." So what does this conversation reveal about the apostles, the disciples? I think it's pretty easy. It reveals that they had a lot of sinful pride. To have a conversation like that, they would have had to have some sinful pride. And I don't think I need to prove that any further to you. If you've read in the Gospels for any amount of time, you know that these guys had a lot of pride. So can you relate to that? Is that an obstacle you face in your discipleship? Yes. And I don't think that's a blind spot for many of us. It shouldn't be breaking news that your pride is an obstacle to your discipleship. If you look back at Mark 8:34, there's another popular verse in that discourse apart from the take up your cross and follow me teaching. In verse 36, Jesus asked that familiar question, "For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul?" So when Jesus asked that question, does that imply that we need to try to succeed at balancing the physical and spiritual life? Is that what that question Jesus is asking is implying. Because when I look around, when I look at myself, that must be the way I interpret his question. Because I'm really trying to balance both. And I don't think that's what Jesus is expecting of us. But when you look around at the lives we have built for ourselves, the social demands, the ladders we're all trying to climb, the careers we're trying to build, the goals we chase after, the castles that we live in, and the riches that we store up and spend our lives taking care of and trying to make grow. And I know we do these things out of necessity to an extent. We have families to take care of, we're expected to take care of, and we have lives that are meant to be lived. So I'm not saying those things are in and of themselves sinful, but when will it all ever be enough? How far will your pride carry you? And how do you even have the time and energy for the kingdom of God? Because I can tell you right now in my life, as I'm speaking to you, I barely have the time and energy. I am stretching myself thin right now, and I'm going to be over the next few years, because right now I'm working on my career. I'm trying to build my career up. I'm trying to grow my family. I'm trying to build a good life, and it's a grind. It's hard work. And many of you had to go through that same thing at this age, because you have to put in that work to get to a good standard of living. And there's nothing wrong with hard work, but who is it that is requiring this American hustle we all participate in? Who is requiring that of us? Maybe it's nothing more than our sinful pride. Maybe it's just the devil whispering in your ear, you've got to be great. You've got to build the good life. But at what cost? So deny your pride, take up your cross, and follow him. Let's look at the final instance of Jesus foretelling his death in Mark chapter 10. In verse 32 through 45. And again, pay attention to the conversation that's going to follow the foretelling. 10:32. And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed. And those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise." And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to him and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." And Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they said to him, "We are able." And Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." And when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. And Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant. And whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." The Sons of Thunder are at it again. And if you don't remember, that was the nicknames for James and John, the sons of Zebedee. And they were nicknamed that for their fiery personalities. There was a story that Luke shares where they were with Jesus at one point, James and John, in a Samaritan village. And they came upon some rude and unwelcoming Samaritans. And they wanted to call down fire from heaven and torch the place. So that's That's why they were called the Sons of Thunder. So it's not exactly shocking to see them requesting positions of authority in the kingdom. And once again, Jesus is forced to explain the way it actually is. And again, I'm the king. Look at what I'm doing right now. I'm here to serve you. I'm here to die for you. That's what the kingdom is about. It's about being a servant. Yet these two guys are jockeying for position. So what does this conversation reveal about the apostles, about the disciples? I think it's pretty simple. They were craving power. They were craving positions of authority. And it's understandable. I mean, these guys were brought out of nothing. And then they got to go on this amazing adventure where they got to see the power of God. They got to see the supernatural power of God in the flesh. So they were no longer going to be content with fishing. They were not going to go back to that ordinary life where they were subjected to the paycheck they got for the fishing, the life where they were subjected to the Roman authorities. They wanted power. They wanted position. They wanted to lord over others as they had once been lorded over. They wanted that authority to call down fire on others. That's what they were looking for. So can you relate to that? Is that an obstacle you face in your discipleship? And maybe this problem is not as pervasive for all of us, but those of us who are afflicted with that desire for authority and power will be able to relate to this. Those of us who strive to be leaders struggle very much with this obstacle. And I have never wanted to bring down fire on anyone. I'm not talking about that. But leaders get into these positions of leadership usually for good reasons. They have noble intentions. They want to make a positive difference. And for a while, they do a great deal of good for those they are leading. But then somewhere along the way, those leaders, they become indignant towards the people they are leading because some people are not falling in line. They're no longer staying in their place. They're working against you. And those leaders, they think, how dare you buck against me? After everything I've done for you, you're acting in this way. And then those leaders, they start to use their power. Instead of serving, they use their power to try to put others back in line, to control people. And maybe you have no idea what I'm talking about, and you've never thought these thoughts or experienced anything like this, and maybe I'm just a sinful maniac. But I take solace in the fact that John, the apostle that Jesus loved, dealt with the same issues. So if you don't, At least I've got John behind my back. But I think it's tempting to bring it to a more relatable place. Maybe if you don't struggle with this, it's tempting for many of us who grew up in the church, you know that term, who grew up in the church. It's tempting for us to exercise our authority in the church because we belong. And that sense of belonging brings about a sense of power over others. And much like the Sons of Thunder did, right? And too often we lose sight of what the church is. It's not our club. It's not our tradition. The church belongs to Jesus Christ. And he says, whoever would be great among you must be a servant. He says, you must be a slave of all. So deny your authority, take up your cross, and follow him. So when I sat down to study Mark 8 through 10 to get prepared for this, I found that I had a lot in common with these apostles and the things they struggled with, the obstacles they faced. And Jesus, in these three chapters we just looked at, he's telling these guys right to their face that, hey, I'm about to be rejected. They're going to spit on me. They're going to flog me. They're going to beat me. And then they're going to put me on a cross and kill me. But then I'm going to raise from the dead. He told them that three times, and we read about those three occasions today. and they listened, all right? Except that one time Peter interrupted him. But they usually listened, they nodded, they understood. And then 1 minute later, they turn around and allow the flesh to control them. And they begin having these conversations we looked at. Who's the greatest? Stuff like that. And it's no different for us, though. We know what Jesus did. We know he died for us. We wouldn't be here if we didn't know that. But oftentimes, the minute we walk out of this door, we forget that. And it comes back around to, what do I need now? I need lunch. What am I going to do to entertain myself today? How am I going to be comfortable? It can't be that way if you're going to follow Jesus. And it's hard. It's hard. It's a high calling. And many who confess the name of Jesus will never actually take up their cross and follow him. That's the fact of the matter. And that's because we feel shame about discipleship, because it requires us to be different. You won't fit in if you're a disciple of Christ. You will be rejected. And coupled with that, our pride, it's pulling us in so many different directions. It's distracting us. It's expending all of our energy. And maybe we are pursuing good things. I like to think I am pursuing good things. But what are we chasing after? Are we chasing after the will of God? Are we chasing after Jesus? Or are we just being controlled by the pride of life? And when that pride is fed and fostered, it grows into an unhealthy craving for power, because we've made it. We've conquered the world, and people better recognize my power, my authority. There are just so many obstacles we don't always see. And the purpose of this lesson is not for you to feel terrible about yourself. I mean, it's not the end of the world if you feel terrible about yourself. That'll prompt change. But even if you feel terrible about yourself and you go home and you work harder, and then you should work harder, you're going to find quickly that no matter how hard you work, the cross that you are supposed to bear is too heavy for you. That's what you're going to find out. So take comfort in this. Jesus did not want to carry his cross either. Jesus did not want to carry his cross either. Think back to before he died. He was in that garden pouring his heart out to God. He was the blood sweat, right? He was under major duress. He was overwhelmed. And he's begging God, let this cup pass from me. Let me out from under the weight of what I have to endure. Jesus was doing that. But do you remember how he ended that prayer? He said to God, not my will, but your will be done. He surrendered himself to God. And then when it came time for him to carry that cross, on his back, his mangled back, to carry it up Calvary's hill, where they were going to kill him on that cross he was carrying, Jesus got it to the top. He had some help, we read about in one of the Gospels. But that cross made it to the top of Calvary's hill, because God carried him. He got him up that hill. And then when they killed him on that cross, 3 days later, God raised him up out of the grave, just like Jesus said it was going to happen. And he'll do the same for us. He'll do the same for us. But we have to surrender to his will. The cross you are to bear is too heavy for you, and that's why it's going to be carried for you. That's why Jesus already carried the cross. So deny yourself. Take up the cross. Surrender your life to him. Surrender your will to him. Give him your everything, and he'll carry that cross. I leave you with the words of Jesus. Come unto me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your soul. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light.